Hello, my name is Tucker Johnson, and I am your host today as we experience NIMSY Live, where we talk about the latest and greatest in translation, localization, internationalization, culturalization, and all that fun stuff global companies need to delight their international customers. On this program, we invite guests who like to have fun and have some value to add for our audience of globalization professionals. I'm always eager to provide a platform to those with a good story or a good data set. So let us know if there are any topics you'd like covered or guests we should reach out to for future episodes. If you haven't already done so, make sure that you are subscribed to NIMSY Insights. Now is your chance. We are coming to you live today on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, maybe X, and whatever your platform of choice is. Go give NIMSY Insights a like and a follow, and you will be one of the first people to know when we publish new industry insights, publish new research. We're constantly publishing great resources for the industry, so make sure that you are following us online. Speaking of great resources for the industry, I want to give a quick shout out to our behind the scenes guest, so to speak, today, which is Multilingual Media. Multilingual Media is a publishing platform. We have a print magazine that we publish every month. We publish daily online news all about translation, localization, the industry in general. No matter who you are, if you are an industry executive, if you are a marketing professional, if you are a translator, there's something to be found here for you at multilingual.com. Another quick shout out, if you're not a reading person like me and you prefer the podcast format, then make sure to check out Localization Today. It's Multilingual's online podcast format, quick industry snippets. In a few minutes every day, you can keep up on the industry, all of the latest trends. Do it while you're walking, do it while you're working, do it while you are working out, however you want to consume your podcast, available on all podcast platforms. Likewise, through summer, it's been event season, and I don't know about you, but LokeWorld is coming up. I'm going to be attending LokeWorld. I hope to see many of you there. If you haven't checked out the events calendar for Multilingual, check it out. There are so many great industry events in our industry, and most of them, I dare to say, are cataloged here. You can go check them out and find your next event, see how to spend your boss's event budget over here at multilingual.com/event. Now, I wanted to give a shout out to Multilingual today because our two guests have upcoming articles in Multilingual Magazine, and I'll get to that in just a sec. Let me introduce the topic today. Today, we are excited to bring you a conversation that will shine a light on a critical and often overlooked topic in language access, the importance of supporting indigenous languages, particularly Mayan languages, in both public and private sectors. Joining me today are two outstanding guests who will bring deep expertise and passion to this field of language access. First, we have Jace Norton, founder of Maya Bridge, a company dedicated to providing meaningful language access for rare Central and South American languages, including Mayan languages. Jace not only leads Maya Bridge in bridging the gap between communities, but is also fluent in Spanish and the Mayan language Quechua. He's at the forefront of ensuring that indigenous language speakers have their voices heard and their needs are met here in the U.S. Jace, welcome to NIMSY Live.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Next up, we have Evandro, who we all know and love. Evandro's a legend in the world of interpreting. He's former chief interpreter for the United Nations and brings decades of experience working at the highest levels of diplomacy and multilingual communication. He's a champion for the idea that language access isn't just a courtesy, but a right, particularly for communities who historically have been marginalized. Evandro, welcome back.
Well, welcome, Jace, to the show, because I've been here a few times. And yeah. Happy to be here again, Tucker.
We're going to put you on the Thanks left side of the screen next time. We'll put you in the host chair.
I know.
You're fitting right in around here. So both Jace and Evandro will be featured in the upcoming issue of Multilingual Magazine. Like I mentioned, we publish a print. Multilingual publishes a print sent directly to your mailbox. If you're not a subscriber, why the heck aren't you a subscriber? Go to multilingual.com and subscribe. This is the latest issue with a beautiful cover for LokeWorld Monterey coming up. It's a false cover. Inside, we have the cover story, The Globetrotting Journey of Translated Nine. If you're not following the crazy pirates of our industry, those crazy Italian pirates, then go read about it in Multilingual. So, Jace and Evandro both have articles coming up in multilingual, and I think that's a great place to start this conversation today, because Jace was introduced to me by Evandro, who was introduced to Evandro through the research that he was doing for this article. So Evandro, why don't you tell us a little bit about that journey, how you tell us about your article and tell us about the journey that brought Jason to the podcast today.
Happy to. I have a column in Multilingual Magazine. It's a bi-monthly column called Past Tense, where I talk about language episodes, anything language that happened in the past. So it could be a war, it could be the disappearance of a language, it could be many different things. So I try to go into interesting things that we hardly know. And for the upcoming article, the one that will be in the October edition, I said, well, what about, you know, the languages spoken in America, particularly in Central America, by the time Columbus got here? What happened to those languages? How many are they? And so then I started digging into that. And then I, you know, stumbled over this thing, Mayan languages, right? Which I didn't know was a thing, right? We all hear about the Maya culture and the Aztecs in Mexico and so on, and the Incas in Peru.
And that's something, not to derail you completely, but that's something if Evandro hasn't heard about a language. And I'm humbled every once in a while, too, where I've been in this industry for decades.
Yeah.
And I'm like, how do you spell that? Did I pronounce Quechua correctly? Jace will tell me.
And again, I started stumbling over these things that I could hardly even pronounce, Quechua. And so on in so many other languages. And I said, well, I didn't know this was such a vast universe. And as I started digging into this, I even went back to, the website ethnologue.org, where you have a glimpse of every language available on the planet. I started to take a look elsewhere. And when I checked Brazil, where I come from, it's 192 languages that are active in Brazil, several of them, of course, indigenous languages. And I started, you know, more than anything, getting the sense of amazement at how little I knew about the subject. So I was amazed at my own ignorance, if you will. And I started looking for subjects on the matter. So from Maya, on a quick search online, that took me to Maya Bridge, which is Jace's company. And soon enough, we were talking. He was gracious to have me on a call. And we started exploring this. How does one learn those languages? Why would anybody learn those languages? What were you doing in Guatemala, of all places, and so on? And the conversation took a very interesting turn, where not only was I educated on the difference between the Mayas and the Aztecs when it comes to languages, because again, you hear about the La Malinche and how she spoke more, you know, some Mayan languages and some Aztec languages. And I was completely confused, right? So I said, listen, I'm going to write about this because I need to maybe reach out to a few more people who need to have that confusion sorted out. But I think Jace, and again, whom I got to know in the process of this, you know, of researching this, I think Jace, you need to write an article to actually fix the mistakes that I'm going to make in mine. So I'm still going to make a few mistakes in mine. So you need to come in the same edition and have an article there that fixes the whole thing. So that's how I came across Jace. So Jace, perhaps you want to tell us a bit about you.
Yeah, of course. Thank you again. I'm really happy to be here and always excited to have a platform to talk about these issues that are kind of near and dear to me. I know people are probably wondering how a white redheaded man is caught up in all of this. And that's a great question. So it all kind of started back when I was 19 years old. I decided to serve a volunteer service mission for my church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And in that process, you submit an application, you say you're willing to serve a mission, and then they assign you where you're going to go. So I received my assignment saying that I would be going to Guatemala. And my original assignment said that I would be learning the Spanish language. So I spent 9 weeks studying Spanish and getting as familiar as I could with the language. I had grown up in Dallas, Texas, in a largely bilingual community. And so I'd had a lot of exposure to Spanish, which helped me to learn relatively quickly and be able to pick up the language. And as soon as I got to Guatemala and began my actual service, I was reassigned to go and learn this other language, which is called Kekchi. So Tucker, you nailed it. That's exactly how you pronounce it. If you're pronouncing it in English, if you're pronouncing it in the actual language, it's pronounced Kekchi. So a little bit different. But yeah, I was tasked with basically working with the Kekchi people in Alta Verapaz, and was in villages where they did not speak any Spanish at all. And so just by a lot of determination, sweat, tears, I was able to learn the language. And I spent 2 years, the majority of that time, working with the Kekchi people. And by the time I returned home from Guatemala, I was fluent in both Kekchi and Spanish. And I, at that point, you know, I considered myself somewhat educated about, you know, indigenous languages, particularly of Guatemala. I thought, wow, nobody really knows about these languages, that they exist, that they're still spoken. And I kind of considered myself to be sort of this like niche expert, but I was still very, very ignorant about like where these languages are found, because I just kind of assumed, like I think most of us would, that, you know, these are languages that they're very isolated. They're only found in those countries where they're spoken. They're not, you wouldn't find a, you know, Kekchi speaker here in the United States. That was what my assumption was. And so I didn't do anything really in terms of language access or interpretation at all for many years, 7 or 8 years. I worked on some projects for my church. They hired me to create language learning guides and applications for other missionaries that were learning Kekchi. But I had no expectations whatsoever that I would be using Kekchi, or that I would, you know, that there would be any opportunity for interpretation here in the United States. My assumption was, you know, I will only really speak this language if I go back to Guatemala. And so I studied Arabic. That was my major in college. I kind of moved on, right? I loved languages. I wanted to study more. So I studied Arabic, lived in Amman, Jordan for a little bit of time. And I had these plans of going into diplomacy in the Foreign Service. And I like to say now that thank goodness that those plans didn't work out.
I think a lot of language industry professionals at one point had plans of diplomacy and foreign service.
Yeah, I mean, it's like, as you know, I love languages, I love cultures, I love learning languages and about being able to access these cultures through language. So, you know, the idea of someone paying you to go live in a foreign country and learn other languages is very romantic, right? But none of those plans worked out, and I was kind of struggling.
Like me, couldn't pass a background check.
No, not
that's
quite.
My story.
I just couldn't. I couldn't. You know, my circumstances wouldn't allow it, and then I was struggling to find something meaningful to do with my life, and that's when I was recruited to be a Kekchi interpreter. I had written on my LinkedIn, I speak Kekchi, and was reached out to on LinkedIn by a company that needed interpreters for immigration hearings.
Okay.
And so I went into that experience thinking, well, first of all, I thought it was a scam. I thought that someone was trying to steal my information or something. So I kind of ignored it at first. And then they reached out again like a month later and said, hey, just following up, we really need your help. And so then I pursued it, and it turned out to not be a scam. And I went into it thinking that, you know, this would be a great opportunity to kind of practice my language, keep up my language skills, and make a few, you know, extra bucks twice a year. That's kind of what I expected. So I went through the training.
You couldn't tell that there was such demand for those obscure languages, right?
No. I would have never had any idea. And I talk about this in the article that I wrote for Multilinguals, that there's this idea of perspectives and perceptions, right? Your perception is basically, it's completely dependent on your surroundings. And so most of us, because we're not having any input, any exposure to these issues, our perception is that they don't exist, that they're not there. And that perception changes with position, right? As you change your position, you can see things that you couldn't see before. You can gain new information about something you thought you knew a lot about, gain completely new information. And so this idea of a perspective is you're kind of forcing yourself by learning, by changing your position, you're forcing yourself to see things in a different light. And so my perceptions were, you know, based on what I was experiencing living in the state of Utah or in Kansas where I grew up. I had never ever seen anyone that spoke an indigenous Latin American language. So I had no, I didn't have the ability to really see things as they truly were. And so as I started interpreting, I was doing 12 to 15 cases a week and flying to essentially every major city in the United States every single week to provide immigration hearing interpretation. And so that's when my perception really started to become more realistic. I started to understand that there was a lot of demand for the Kekchi language and that there were a lot of individuals that had come and migrated from Guatemala and were living now in the United States. And, you know, my first case was in New York City and
let me ask you this.
Sure.
Why would anybody, particularly from that community, come live in the States? Why? What are they fleeing from? What is the reality on the ground? Why are they seeking shelter in the U.S.? Because you told me you mostly handle cases involving minors, right?
Correct.
You need protection and shelter. So, and I know there's a history of violence if you go back, you know, centuries in the region with all the colonization efforts and so on and so forth. But it looks like the violence still remains, albeit in a different form, right? So what brings these people to the U.S.?
That's a good question. And, you know, again, the thing that I've really come to learn as my perceptions have changed, as I've, you know, forced myself to view things through different perspectives, is that these issues that, you know, we've really been focused on the Mayan languages of Guatemala because they've been very high demand. But these issues are really kind of, they share many commonalities across the board with indigenous groups from all across the globe. And really that when the reality is that indigenous groups, because, you know, of these language barriers that exist and because of cultural differences, they are more vulnerable, right? Within their own societies. They're vulnerable because they don't have access in the same way that their, you know, their counterparts that are not indigenous or don't identify as indigenous do, right? They face many different barriers. And so that is kind of a huge factor. And there's many different groups, individuals, organizations, governments that exploit indigenous people. And they do face violence. In fact, you know, many people aren't really aware that in Guatemala specifically, there was a genocide that happened from the 60s to the 80s, late 80s in Guatemala. And this it was framed as this civil conflict. But in truth, it was a genocidal campaign by the Guatemalan government that was non-indigenous against indigenous people. And they were after indigenous people's lands. Indigenous people were, you know, wanting to have basic human rights that they were not getting. And so the military basically murdered, raped, killed, and forcefully displaced millions of individuals. So you have this kind of starting point, I think, of an exodus of many, many indigenous people to the United States in that time period, who were fleeing specifically this genocide. And as they fled to the United States and as they found shelter and refuge here in the United States, they began to form these communities. And I had no idea, right, until I began interpreting that there were so many communities of indigenous populations. And the same essential story is true of many, many different groups all around the world who are facing discrimination, who are facing injustice, violence, persecution, and inaccessibility. The, you know, just if you just look at the educational piece of it, you know, Guatemala has extremely low, very, very poor resources for education. And then when you compound that with the speakers of indigenous languages in those communities, it's even worse. And so when you just, I mean, there's so many different factors that are causing people to come here, and every one of them is, you know, significant, right? So they've formed many different communities, and it's not just Guatemalans, it's Africans, it's people from Mexico, from South America. And the sort of the reason that we don't really notice them, one of the big reasons, is that they are kind of hidden behind this extra barrier, right? So speakers of Guatemalan indigenous languages are often grouped in with just, you know, Latino Hispanic communities. We view them as, okay, they're from Guatemala, and so they are Spanish speakers, they're Latinos, they're Hispanic, whatever. And we don't realize that they're actually within that diaspora. They're in their own diaspora. They have limited Spanish proficiency. Right. So in our industry, we have recognized, right, we need to provide in, you know, in the United States, anyone who doesn't speak English or has limited English proficiency, we need to provide them with an interpreter. But we're still behind the curve when it comes to limited Spanish proficient, limited Portuguese proficient, limited French proficient, limited Russian proficient. I mean, the list is really, it goes on and on. Because this is true of almost everywhere in the world. There's indigenous groups that exist in almost every single country. We just don't really know about them or hear about them because they are kind of behind this curtain, right?
And this is your, for the audience, my fellow Americans, this is your weekly reminder that America does not have an official language. English is not the official language of the United States. So when we're talking about limited Spanish proficient, that what we're talking about there is for some of these groups, the best practice in many cases, because if you don't want to, you know, fly Jace out first class to your hearing, your best practice is to have relay interpreters.
And that's something that is important to talk about is to when you're wanting to address this demand, which is significant, right? There's 22 Mayan languages spoken in Guatemala. Just in Guatemala, there's 22 Mayan languages plus two additional non-Mayan indigenous languages just in Guatemala. You have over 60 indigenous languages in Mexico with over 300 linguistic variants of those languages, meaning that although technically there's 60 languages, each one has usually several regional variants that are not mutually intelligible. So, and because of this kind of surge in migration, right, there's many different factors, natural disasters, there's discrimination, there's violence against women. All these different factors are combining to, you know, push people to want to migrate to the United States.
And then,
and in an increasingly globalized, connected world where, you know, I recently was in Guatemala, and even in the most remote villages where, you know, they just are now just barely getting electricity via solar panels, they all have smartphones. And so you can see, you have, you know, visual sort of evidence of communities and people that are living in the United States that have better accessibility, right? That have access to better education, that are able to work, that have jobs, right? That aren't, you know, the discrimination maybe is not quite as severe as what it would be in their home country. So there's kind of this link that allows them to really, you know, conceptualize the difference of their lifestyle that they could have.
And no, so, Jace, you told me in the course of our conversation that several of the speakers of Mayan languages cannot read or write, not even their language. They haven't been schooled, right? And a question that remained with me was, are these languages such that they do not have a written record, or do they have a written record? It's just that they haven't been schooled to a point where they can actually learn it.
Yeah, well, that's a really great question and very important to talk about when you talk about indigenous language access. And again, this concept applies usually universally to all Indigenous languages. Typically, they are not taught in schools, right? If there is a written component, which usually the written component, you know, like with the Mayan languages, for example, they used to have a very sophisticated form of writing that was a hieroglyphic and a phonetic alphabet. And it was began to kind of lose the utilization of the written language as the kind of the decline of the Mayan civilization came, but they still had it. And then when the sort of colonial forces came into the Yucatan and into Guatemala and those areas, they actually purposefully burned all of the Mayan codices. And they did this to try and essentially just squash out these languages and their cultures and their beliefs. They viewed them as pagan, as heathen languages.
Barbarians, yeah.
And so,
barbarians, right?
Yeah. Right, exactly. And this is the same concept. You see this all over the world, right? That the term barbarian actually comes from the idea of bada, 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 right? We can't understand what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah. Sounds like bada, bada, bada to us. This concept is, it's a universal thing that happens when a dominant culture is kind of discriminating against a marginalized culture, right? This actually happened within the Aztec Empire. The Aztecs were sort of the main force in Mexico for a great period of time. And there were many civilizations that were kind of controlled by this Aztec Empire. So you have languages that have names now that are like Popoloca or Popoluca or Otomi, which are like these offensive like non-names that they gave to the language. You know, we don't know what you're saying, so we're Popoloco, that's what you sound like, so we're just going to call you Popoloco, right? Or Otomi. Otomi, I think, means like idiot in Nahuatl, right? Which was the language of the Aztecs. Mm-hmm. So this happens. It's a universal concept, right? That happens everywhere. You have a dominant society and they have their language, and everyone else that doesn't speak that language, they consider to be savages. You know, you're less than, right? And so.
But Jason, a concept that I got wrong, and that perhaps many of our listeners may be confused about as well, is that I thought the Mayan civilization had ceased to exist when Cortes arrived, right? When the Spaniards arrived. But by then, according to you, they were already pretty much in decline. They had already seen their prime, and they were already kind of fading away into the background. So Cortes is not to blame entirely for that, you know, erasure, if you will, of their culture. Is that correct? A correct assessment?
Yeah, I think that's a correct assessment. I mean, this happens many, many, many times in Latin American civilizations, where civilizations have this zenith and then another civilization comes, and through, you know, wars or conquests, natural disasters, you see kind of these declines. The Mayan civilization was arguably the greatest civilization in Latin America, because it was just a lot more advanced. It was the longest lasting, right? But yes, by the time that the Spanish colonial forces started coming to the Americas, the Mayan civilization had already seen its zenith. It was kind of in a period of decline. Major cities had already been abandoned. But those languages, which, by the way, there's 30 Mayan languages spoken throughout southern Mexico and the Yucatan, Guatemala and Belize, and then even as you get down, there's very small pockets as you get further down to Central America and other parts of Central America. But these languages persisted, and these cultures, although they may not have been a great civilization, they still had their own cultures, right? And you can see that when you go to Guatemala, you see, if you look at the linguistic sort of map of Guatemala, you can see all of the different, you know, cultures that are these splinters of this once great Mayan civilization. And all of those languages are showing up here in the United States, right? And I think that's the thing that, again, we don't, as an industry, as a society, we haven't reckoned with this idea that not only are these languages still alive, there are millions of speakers of these languages when you look at the aggregate of all of the different languages. And many of them are here in the United States, and they don't speak Spanish, right? That's a huge misconception, is that most people think that, you know, if you speak an indigenous Latin American language, it's just your second language. You must also speak Spanish, or you must also speak Portuguese. And that's not the case for millions of
people. If that were the case, you wouldn't have had to learn those languages, right?
That's exactly right.
They all spoke Spanish, yeah.
Right, yeah. And so, you have, and this is true, again, of all over the world. You have groups of people that have limited proficiency in the dominant language of their country. And so, for example, we just recently got a request for Ingush, which is a language from Russia. It's an indigenous group that's over 600,000 people living in Russia that speak their own language. And it's, you know, the same concept everywhere. And then you get into Africa, and there's, you know, tons of languages in Africa. And so, you know, as an industry, what we're trying to advocate for currently is we're trying to advocate for the idea that it's not good enough to just get them to their second language that they have limited proficiency in. We need to get to their actual native languages and be able to provide them interpretation services in those indigenous languages. And going back to what we talked about with the written component, now, you know, many indigenous languages, because of the sort of decentralization of their civilizations, but also because of extreme purposeful tactics from colonial forces to really, you know, stamp out their civilizations, they have lost those writing systems. And so they are predominantly oral languages, right?
But are they endangered? Do you see them as endangered languages, or have we captured enough of the stories, the philosophy, the worldview in that language to now be able to reconstruct it later? Or
yeah.
have we at least captured the knowledge that is embedded in the language?
It's kind of a two-part question, right, Evandro? Because is the language endangered, or is the alphabet endangered, right?
There's several languages that are considered critically endangered, right? There's many languages that are critically endangered. In fact, I think 170 languages, something like that, in the United States are labeled as critically endangered, meaning that there are very, very few speakers left. And because they haven't really developed that writing system, it is going to be very difficult to conserve that language. And so, with the Guatemalan Mayan languages, for example, to my knowledge, they're considered what we would call stable, meaning that there's enough speakers that are continuing to pass it on. However, I do think that there is a very real danger that if we don't work to, you know, work on efforts to continue to write things in these languages, that they will be lost. Because as an oral language, you know, it's really dependent upon the parents to teach their children, right? These are not taught in schools. They're not really taught in an official capacity. And so it's really on the parents to teach these languages. And many parents, they've been discriminated against their whole life because they are indigenous and because they don't speak Spanish or they don't speak the main language of their country.
They don't want the kids to speak it, right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. There's this sentiment where they say, no, I don't want you to learn our language because you'll be discriminated against. I don't want you to experience that. So I'm not going to teach you. I just want you to learn Spanish and that's it. And then you'll have a better life than what I had, right? That's a very prevalent way of thinking. And it's, you know, it's really sad because that is what will, you know, what will eventually kill these languages, as if people stop learning them. So, you know, what we're trying to do is, right now we've been kept very busy just supporting the need that's there here in the United States, being a reliable source for organizations that are encountering people that speak these languages and being able to actually get them interpreters. And going back to what we talked about earlier, we have to use a variety of English to the target language and Spanish to the target language interpreters.
Well, and let's back up just a sec, because I don't think I ever properly introduced your company, Maya Bridge, right?
Yeah.
And so tell us a little bit. We heard about your background and how you came to be fluent in other languages and kind of fell into this industry. At what point did you found Maya Bridge? What is the mission of Maya Bridge? What do? Who do you work with?
And is Mayan languages all you do, or do you also get to translate and interpret other languages?
So when we started, right, I'd been an interpreter for Kekchi for a little over a year. And I had been interpreting for immigration hearings primarily. And then I started branching out and doing other types of interpretation, which eventually led me to work in the unaccompanied minors sphere. So I was recruited to work on site at an emergency intake site for unaccompanied minors. And that's when I really saw that it wasn't just Kekchi, right? It was dozens of other languages from Guatemala, many, many languages from Mexico, and then other indigenous languages from Africa, from other places. So when I founded Maya Bridge in 2021, because I knew that I had to do more than what I could just do on my own. And so I started this company in 2021 with the idea that we were going to subcontract to our current, my current employer at the time. We were going to subcontract to them and help provide predominantly the Mayan languages, right? So I named the company Maya Bridge. And we started really providing services in like 6 to 8 different Mayan languages that were the most high demand. And we did that for a time, but I knew that there was still so much more to be done, right? That providing these languages was not enough, just for this kind of one site, right? And not really for the general public. And so I decided we needed to kind of expand. And so over the last year and a half, we've really put in a lot of work to expand. And we have made ourselves a resource that anybody can reach out to, right? So now we work with hospitals, we work with immigration courts, we work with state and local courts, school districts, really anybody that is needing a language that is harder to find. And it started off with predominantly Latin American indigenous languages. We grew from having sort of these 8 Mayan languages from Guatemala to expanding to include predominant languages from Mexico, like Mixteco, Zapoteco, other languages. And then we started doing a little bit from South America as well, like Quechua, Aymara. But as we started to expand, we found that so many different people started reaching out and saying, well, you have helped us with these languages, but now we're needing a West African language. Or now we're needing an Asian indigenous language or a lower diffusion language from Central Asia or whatever it may be. And so we realized that in the industry in general, there's this the kind of trend is that a language company obviously is going to go after providing the service that's most needed, which is going to be those top, 80 languages, let's say, that are the most predominant. So you're doing Spanish and Mandarin and Arabic and all these predominant languages,
It's
which is
easy. It's just the quickest. It's the easiest.
well, and
It
it's
makes sense. It's supply and demand,
yeah,
right?
exactly.
So, but it
And
doesn't mean that there's any. That's the problem with languages, is because the supply and demand curve absolutely applies to our industry. But supply and demand and economic principles, just in general, are they're cold. They're black and white. They're math, and they don't apply. Well, they do apply, but they may not be appropriate to apply to many human-centered areas, right? Because don't tell me about supply and demand if you have an unaccompanied minor who needs to communicate, right?
Right. You're exactly right. I mean, when you look at it, and this it's not like the these larger businesses are bad or that they don't have heart or have empathy. It's just that empathy when you're trying to run a business, it kind of only extends so far because again, you are looking at data. And many times, like we talked about, the true data is kind of hidden because I've come across many people who will say, well, we don't really see demand for this set of languages. We don't really see it. And my immediate thought is, yeah, that's exactly right. You don't see it, but it's there. It's that same concept of your perception, right? And these executives that are kind of at these higher levels are looking at that data, right? Which is pretty black and white. It's pretty cold, like you said. And that's exactly what we set out to do was we set out to not focus on what everyone else is already doing a good job of. we're trying to do what everyone else is doing kind of as an afterthought or as not their main focus. We're making that our main focus. And we're really, really focusing on the humanity of, it doesn't matter that this language we only get a request for twice a year, but when that request comes through, we don't want that individual to not be able to communicate. We want them to be able to speak in their own language. And so, you know, for us, we go after those kinds of languages, which I think from many, you know, from a business, a purely business perspective, many larger companies would say, why would we, you know, why would we spend our time and resources recruiting? And the recruiting, by the way, is not your typical, you can't just put an ad out and say, you know, I need a Chalchiteco.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Yeah, how do you find more people like you? Because not everyone was a missionary in Guatemala and had a chance to learn those languages. So how do you go about training? Let's say you find someone who's promising, knows the language, knows enough English. And so how do you go about providing training or making sure that person has received enough training? How does that go?
Yeah, so I mean, it's definitely a challenge because one of the things that we have done that's helped us to be successful to have, you know, on-demand resources is that we work with individuals who don't speak English and they are interpreting from the target language into Spanish. And many of our clients, that's okay. They already are bilingual Spanish. And so they don't need us to get them to English. They're okay with target language to Spanish. So one of the challenges in this industry is that there's really very, very little resources for if you speak Spanish, right? If you don't speak English, there aren't nearly as many resources for trainings on interpretation. So, you know, we've worked with some partners to help emphasize the importance that we do need to get better training in Spanish so that we can access a wider pool of resources. So we've really, you know, had somewhat of an influence there. We provide our own in-house training. We work with individuals that are experienced interpreters, and we then use them to help provide some training when it's necessary to provide that coaching and feedback. So, you know, it's something that I'm really working towards is developing the best training that we can. Right now, it's a little bit, you know, I guess you would call informal, right? We're having more of like one-on-one coaching more than anything with our interpreters and kind of getting them to the table and getting their foot in the door with lower stakes interpretation before we, you know, have them do something that's very technical, like a court hearing or a medical case. But more needs to be done for training indigenous language interpreters. And really, you know, that's what you have to do. If you want to satisfy this demand that does exist, you have to bring people into the industry. You cannot rely on there being enough resources as is, because you will fall short. You just will. And so you have to go out and you have to find people that have the skills of being bilingual and sometimes trilingual. And you have to educate them about the fact that there is a need, right? Many of them don't know that there's a need for interpretation. Mm-hmm. They never, just like most of us, right? Depending on your circumstances, your environment, if you've never seen that need or heard about, you know, oh, you can work as an interpreter virtually, they would have no knowledge of that. So we have gone out and we've gone to communities and we've talked to people and we've told them that there's opportunities to work. And then we've brought them into the industry, help them get sort of base level training, and then help them get that experience.
Now, Jace, one question that I asked you back then when we first spoke, and that I'm going to ask you again at the risk of being, you know, of sounding very stupid again,
sure,
is, again, when you look at Mayans versus Aztecs and Incas, what is the timeline? Who came first? And to what territories and so on? Because I know that they intersected over the border, you know, with what is now Mexico.
Right.
But the Incas are a totally different phenomenon. They're down in Peru and South America and so on. But it's particularly between the Mayans and the Aztecs. If you could give us a good timeline just to help my colleagues understand. Again, I'm assuming they are as ignorant as I am. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'm the only one who's stupid here. But
I could answer, but I'm going to let Jace.
I know. Yeah.
You know, I don't want to outshine.
Right.
Well, thank you, Tucker.
full transparency, right? I'm not by any means a historian, right? So this is all things that I've learned that's out there, public information. But when we think about the Aztecs, Mayans, and Incans, those are kind of like the big three, right, that we have some surface knowledge about, typically because that's what they teach us in school, right? They teach us about these civilizations. And the Aztecs and the Incas, I think, are the most recognizable because they were what existed at the time that Spanish colonialism first started. And the Mayan civilization, I think, is more recognizable because it was so big and because it was the largest and most influential civilization in the Americas, right? So the Mayan civilization, you know, it started like 2000 years BC, right? And that's like when it started, and it lasted until around 900 AD, right? And so it was a very long lasting period of civilization. And it's actually considered a cradle of civilization, meaning that it independently became, you know, this kind of bastion of civilization, right? You know, for example, the Mayans independently developed the concept of the zero, right? This placeholder in mathematics. They had very advanced astrology and other, you know, agricultural techniques, other things that made them a very big civilization. And again, the writing was a big part of it as well. They had the most developed writing system of any civilization in the Americas. But the Aztecs and the Incas, I think, are more famous because they were what we found, right? What the European colonialists found when they came.
They're closer to home, so to speak. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
And they are they had many predecessors that came before them, right? So you had like the Olmecs and also came before, but also existed at the same time. So like the Zapotecs and the Olmecs, right, in Mexico. There were many different civilizations in Mexico. In South America, you have the Nazca, and you have a lot of civilizations that predate the Incas. And so, you know, like I said, we know about the Incas and the Aztecs because they were kind of what existed when they were discovered in the Americas in the 15th, 16th centuries. But there's so, that's just kind of the tip of the iceberg, right? There's so many other civilizations that existed all throughout the Americas that, you know, either didn't, you know, reach as great of a zenith, or just had already had their zenith by the time that they were, you know, the Americas were really discovered. So, you know, when you talk about the timeline, like you talked about earlier, the Mayans had already seen a bit of decline, right, by the time that the colonialists came. And it's very fascinating too. A lot of people, and I myself had no idea about this, but the Aztecs and the Spaniards, to some extent, teamed up to conquer Guatemala. And so that's why all of the names, including the name of the country itself, are not Mayan names. They're actually Nahuatl, which is the Aztec, predominant Aztec language, right, of the Aztec Empire. So all of the names like Quetzaltenango, Huehuetenango, these come from Aztec words, not Mayan words, which is very fascinating, which, you know, something that I had no idea about.
But you're not an expert on this. So as you clarified,
yeah, right.
So I just want to repeat your caveat there.
Sure.
Yeah, what does that make us?
I'm afraid to know what an actual expert would know about this.
Well, no, I'm sure they would have much more knowledge than I do. And I've really like kind of been forced into this because people ask about these things or people, you know, teach me about these things. And I really, you know, like when I talk about the names of Guatemala, for example, I had no idea until just a few years ago that is something that is a fact. And so I have come to gain some level of expertise in comparatively speaking, but I'm certainly not an expert. And if you want a history lesson, you should certainly go to the experts. And by the way, as well, if you want to really get to the you know, indigenous communities and learn about them and their perspectives, go to them, right? I'm not that guy that can give you those perspectives. Yeah. My perspective is, I have seen personally that there's gaps in language access in the United States. And having worked as an interpreter and knowing kind of what the challenges are, what the struggles are, and how to fix those challenges, my expertise really is the language access component, right? About how do we get interpreters for these languages? And just to recap as well, we don't use non-Indigenous speakers or non-native speakers of these languages for the most part. I mean, it really just with Kekchi, where there was this shortage kind of the beginning, and it goes back to the fact that the Kekchi were more isolated in comparison to other Indigenous groups in Guatemala, meaning that they weren't as dramatically affected by this genocide, which ultimately meant that there were fewer refugees, fewer migrants who made it to the United States, which means that fast forward to 2015 and there's a big surge of Guatemalans from, you know, Kekchi speaking areas. It was a lot harder to find native speakers of Kekchi at that time. And that's why I was recruited, right? Because they were sort of this desperation. And so we, you know, my job is now just connecting dots. That's all that I do. I help find the talent who are these native speakers, right? And I help get them training. I help get them in the right places. And then I help connect them with the clients, right? And in many cases, the interpreters that we found and we trained go on and work for other companies. And although that, you know, as a company, it's like kind of a bittersweet experience, because we obviously feel very, you know, like we found these people and we want them to be treated right. We want them to have the great work. But at the same time, we know that everything we're doing, ultimately, the goal is to increase accessibility. Yeah. That's really the goal. At the end of the day, we're very happy anytime that any effort is made to increase accessibility. So that's really our goal. That's our mission, is to increase that accessibility, advocate and kind of educate people about these issues, and then be the resource so that when somebody, you know, at 2 a.m. needs a Quiche interpreter because there's a mother in labor, they can get it, because if they call us, we'll get somebody. And that's ultimately what we strive to do. And we had initially thought that we would focus predominantly on these Latin American languages, but we found that that's not enough. We need to focus on really anything that other companies and other organizations are struggling with. And so we do African Indigenous languages. We do Asian Indigenous languages. We do languages that may not be considered, you know, we would maybe not think of them as Indigenous, but they're sort of lower diffusion that we also focus on. And it's all about just being that resource, being reliable, and taking care of our interpreters and our linguists, making sure that they have, you know, fair access to this industry.
Awesome.
Well, Tucker, I don't know about you, but I think we'll have to do this again.
Yeah, I'm watching the clock here.
We haven't started to scratch the surface here. I have another 50 questions that I want to ask.
We already talked about this. Let's everyone go subscribe to Multilingual, get your print subscription, and a lot of you already have it. And this will be, you got two new articles coming out next month, one from Evandro and then one from Jace, correcting the record on everything that Evandro says.
Exactly.
And go check those out. And I think it makes sense. Let's do this again, gentlemen, after your articles come out, and we can talk about those. As we talked about offline, we could have a weekly podcast on this and not run out of stuff to talk about.
That would be nice.
For a while. That'd be nice. Yeah. Right? So.
Yeah. Yep. There's so much to talk about. There's so many different issues, and, you know.
And there's other people in this field that, like, I'm brainstorming online here, but let's get Lawson Stapleton on here. Let's get, you know, there's other people. Let's get Tim Brooks on here and have a conversation about these type of things. I'm sorry, I'm putting.
Now, can I squeeze in a final question?
Yes.
We have time for one more question.
Yeah, you're the one with the meeting at 10, so.
And again, this is, you know, addressing some trivia, but La Malinche, the famous interpreter who became associated with Cortez and so on, is thought to have, you know, is known to have the ability to speak both Aztec and Mayan languages, right? How is that and why is that? Was there enough cultural and commercial exchanges between the two peoples And how did she develop? And what language was that she spoke on the Mayan side? Three different questions in one, I know, but hey.
These are excellent questions, and this is where my expertise has run out, right? I'm not really familiar. I can give you my best guess, right? Would be that the languages from Mexico, from modern day Guatemala and South America are from different families, meaning that they are linguistically different. But they share a lot of similarities, right? As far as like when I was in Peru recently, I was learning some Quechua, and it's very different from Mayan languages, but there are similar sounds, for example. So like there's a place in Peru called Penco, which you hear that sound, that's a sound that we make in Mayan languages as well. We have those same ejective consonants. And so, I think linguistically speaking, they are different in many, many ways, but share more similarities than, for example, Spanish, right? Or Western languages. They share many more similarities. And certainly I'm sure that there was, mixing between, in terms of trade, in terms of other things, between Mayan cultures and these the Aztec Empire at the time. So it makes sense to me that La Malinche, she would be able to have learned a Mayan language because of some of those shared similarities, but then also because it's like living in Portugal, or living in Brazil, for example. You're exposed to a lot of Spanish from migrants and other things, and the languages share similarities. In the case of Spanish and Portuguese, they share even more similarities than what I think the Mayan and Aztec share. But I think that would be my best guess. And again, you should really, if you're really wanting to get to the heart of that, you should talk to some historians who probably would give a much more eloquent and a better answer than I could.
Excellent. Well, thank you very much, Jason. This has been very educational again for the second time for me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Agreed. Thank you so much to both you gentlemen for coming on today. I'm going to take us out here to close us up before the hour. So, everybody, before I do that, though, I want to encourage you. I put a link. Go follow Jason on LinkedIn. Also, go check out the website, mayabridge.org. Got some very interesting, if you want to learn more, got some very interesting information in the blog there. More information about indigenous languages. It's a great resource. And also, of course, go check out multilingual.com. The new print and digital version will be coming out soon with these gentlemen's articles. And we'll make sure to schedule something else after they do. So, gentlemen, thank you very much for coming on.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you, Tucker. Thank you for having us.
I'll take us out here. So, ladies, gentlemen, chat, we are out of time for today. If you enjoyed this episode of NIMZ Live, then join us next time. We don't have anything on the calendar right now, but follow NIMZ Insights on LinkedIn, and you'll be the first to know when we schedule a new episode. I appreciate our guest today, Jason Evandro. I appreciate my colleagues here at NIMZ Insights doing all the hard work so I can have these interesting conversations. And finally, I appreciate you, the audience, everybody joining us live today, participating in chat over there. Saw some familiar faces. Hello to everybody. I look forward to next time. Cheers.